Shrink Wrap Radio number 574, The Silent Epidemic of REM Sleep Loss, with Ruben Nyman, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my return guest is sleep and dream specialist, Dr. Ruben Nyman, and we're going to be discussing recent findings related to the impact of REM sleep loss on our mental and physical well-being. For more information about Ruben Nyman, PhD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ruben Nyman, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. You know, this is the fourth time that you've been a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio, so you must be doing something right. Not too many people can claim that privilege, actually.
You can't get rid of me, huh?
Well, we're going to be discussing a recent article of yours titled Dreamless, The Silent Epidemic of REM Sleep Loss. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was an interesting topic for us to get into. So what's going on these days with the quality of our sleep, sort of big picture?
Yeah, well, part of the issue is inherent in your question, and that's that we've all learned to essentially subsume dreaming under sleep. And this is one of the issues I raise in the article I wrote, which is published by the New York Academy of Sciences. We, for many, many years, look at dreaming now as a subset of sleep. And in some respects it is, but I think it obscures what dreams are really about. And I think it's a reflection of a larger subtle attitudinal shift that's gone on. It's affected both the public and psychotherapists strongly over a number of decades. Let me give you an example, then I'll highlight this. Last spring, I traveled to Southern California to go to the International Association for the Study of Dreams. I was presenting, in fact, a paper on a similar topic. And I met a buddy there after he picked me up at the airport, and we stopped to get an espresso. And so we're in some coffee shop in Newport Beach, and I look over at a table, and there is a magazine entitled Dream. And I'm thinking, wow, interesting synchronicity. Yeah. I walk over to pick it up, and it was a magazine about real estate. Right. It reminded me that one of the most common uses of the word dream in our world today, as in the American dream, is a house.
Huh. Yeah.
We reduce the notion of dreaming to something in the material world. And I think this reflects a much deeper rooted shift or misunderstanding, a misconstruing of the notion of dream. We've downsized the dream in many, many ways. And this is the reason this epidemic is silent. Again, this is very striking. What I did, a review paper. I looked at the data we have on how certain substances, alcohol, cannabis, many medications, including psych medications and commonly used over-the-counter prescription medications, sleep disorders, and other factors in lifestyle today. I looked at the numbers associated with the suppression of REM sleep, and it's mind-boggling. It may be that we are more dream-deprived than we are sleep-deprived. And we can talk about why I think that is. But the point here is that it's striking that we've had this data for some of it for decades, and nobody pays attention to the fact that we're dreaming less and less and less.
Well, that's an interesting finding right there, I think. I think many of us have been aware that there are sleep problems, and lots of people suffer from sleep problems and take various kinds of medications. I know some of my friends, I'm up in the age range where people seem to struggle more with staying asleep, I think, than maybe falling asleep, although it can go both ways. But, you know, I know of people who are taking Ambien every night for years. I'm not sure it was designed to be taken every night for years.
No, No, the longest studies we have on Ambien run a few weeks, and we also have a lot of anecdotal data. In fact, some additional data showing that long-term use of Ambien is associated with problems, a breakdown of sleep architecture. And some of that becomes very evident in behavior, where people are getting up in the middle of the night, eating unconsciously, engaging in automatic behaviors, getting in their cars, driving, and doing other strange things. But getting back to your point, you know, you're right. It's true. As the population ages, as people get older, they're more likely to have sleep maintenance problems than they are sleep onset problems. It's a bit of an overstatement, but when we're young, we're nervous. When we're older, we're depressed. metaphorically speaking. But what happens later in life is there's much more sleep onset and sleep maintenance insomnia. The numbers bear this out. So the thing is, when we are missing sleep at the beginning of the night, when we have trouble falling asleep, it can compromise literally delta sleep, deep sleep, stage sleep. When we have trouble staying asleep, we're actually losing more dream time. We do most of our epic dreaming in the latter third of the night.
Right.
So here's Hamlet, to sleep, perchance to dream. So those awakenings are less about losing sleep, much more about losing REM sleep or dreaming.
Yeah. And something that I never put together before in my head until I read your article was, we've known for a long time that if you deprive people of REM sleep, we did various studies where, you know, we wouldn't let them dream. Right. And it led to profound cognitive disturbances.
Yes.
They couldn't think straight the next day.
Right.
And, but somehow there's a connection that we didn't make, that to say, well, if to look at how much REM sleep people are getting, and to realize that that will happen not just in the experimental setting when you deliberately deprive people of REM, but if people are deprived of REM for other reasons, their cognitive processes aren't going to be great.
There's no question. In some of the studies you're referring to, they're both animal and human studies where REM sleep is selectively deprived, and these subjects can get all the other sleep they want. There's an interesting pattern. The REM sleep tries to rebound under pressure. It pushes back harder and harder, mm-hmm. and it ends up pushing its way into the early part of the night. It displaces deep sleep, and it turns out that the REM that it sort of breaks the dam, if you will, and gushes back is poor quality REM. Well, that pattern many of us are familiar with, it's called the reduced REM latency. So we saw that in all of these research studies that deprived animals and humans of REM sleep. It turns out that the single most common pattern of sleep and dream in mood disorders, especially in depression, is a reduced REM latency. In other words, depressed individuals look like subjects who've had their dreams deprived. I know when I was in training years ago, we referred to depression metaphorically as a loss of one's dreams. And it looks like there's a literal underpinning that depressed people are losing their dreams. And the cognitive impact of this is profound. A big part of it is mediated by a memory deficit. We know that certain types of memory, procedural memory, for example, are consolidated in REM sleep. And I think memory is so much more than people think it is. It's not just a matter of reading or learning something and filing it in a metaphoric slot in the brain. My best sense of what goes on in REM sleep is it's an experiential digestive process. So in recent years, many of us are aware that we began referring to the digestive system, the gut, the actual gut, as a second brain. Candace Pert and others, of course, were discovering most of the neurotransmitters that were mediating CNS, you know, brain processes, were found in the gut. And when I was looking at it, it made sense to me because the gut has to make some very intelligent decisions, right? I mean, we send all kinds of stuff down there. You know, we swallow all kinds of stuff. And the gut has to decide, and what it's going to keep. It has to sift through. It's a security system, basically. It has to decide it's going to keep this and excrete that. What the gut keeps becomes a part of us. It literally becomes a part of our physicality, our tissues, our energy systems. So if the gut is a brain in digestion, then the brain is a gut during REM sleep. what I mean by that is that there are all of these unprocessed, undigested experiences we're exposed to during the day. Uh-huh. I mean, through the day pretty quickly. We can't process everything. Some of it goes in pretty easily, but there's material that then is metaphorically chewed on, swallowed, digested, sifted through, and assimilated in REM sleep. And so memory is so much more than just learning something. When we achieve new memory, obtain new memory, it becomes a part of our psychology. We're remade in the dream. It makes sense. Morpheus, the Greek god of dreams, so of course is the root of the word morph. We are morphed in our dreams. We're updated. We're redesigned, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If we don't dream well, we're not digesting life experiences. And I think of this dreamless epidemic as resulting in psychological indigestion, more so even it's psychological constipation, which for me has become a synonym for clinical depression. We're not processing information. We're just not processing new experience.
That's really a new way of looking at it. I've been very interested in all the stuff that's coming out about the gut, about the biome, and how there are all these other organisms that are living with, that are a big part of who we are, that we're not aware of, and that whole system needs to be in balance, and that it affects our health, it affects our thinking. Mm-hmm. It's almost hard to grab hold of, you know. This is definitely a new way of thinking about it.
It suggests something that the Pope does and is referenced to ourselves not only as I but as we, right?
The royal we makes more sense now, huh? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you say there's a REM loss epidemic. And we're reasoning that by reasoning backwards, because we know that there are sleep problems? Or is there some other way that assertion based on any other kind of evidence?
Yeah, it is. There are numerous studies, for example, on the impact of alcohol on REM sleep, the impact, less so, but some studies on the impact of cannabis, nicotine, psych meds, antidepressants, benzos, anti-anxiety agents, statins. I mean, we have frequently when drugs are being evaluated by the FDA, one of the factors they look at is its impact on sleep. So we have data from a lot of these studies indicating that, let's start with alcohol. Yeah. You know, Americans drink too much, and the standard, of course, is maybe two drinks or so per day for an average man, one drink for a woman. Women metabolize alcohol not as efficiently as men do, and of course, there are a lot of individual variations. But there's data showing that approximately 25 million Americans consume 8 or more drinks per day. That's a huge number of people, and that's a
25 million, you said, 8 or more drinks per day. Wow.
Yeah. So, and then we have data on people consuming less than that. But anybody consuming, the timing is a factor too, but consuming 3 or more drinks if you're a man, 3 more drinks if you're a woman, you're beginning the risk of damaging REM sleep. And many people know that when they've had a little too much to drink, they'll wake up hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours into sleep. And usually that awakening coincides with the first REM cycle. It's a small REM cycle, but mm-hmm. it appears then. So again, we have a lot of data that suggests that alcohol damages REM sleep.
I've noticed that for myself. You know, I've never been a big drinker. And maybe one of the reasons is that I don't like to sleep poorly. And the same thing with marijuana. You know, I've smoked off and on over the years, but could never get very deeply into it again for that reason, that I don't like to have disturbed sleep.
Right.
You know, doesn't feel good.
With alcohol, there's an old study that an interview study that showed that more than 50% of adult alcoholics reported that they started drinking as adolescents primarily because they couldn't sleep. They were drinking to sleep. And we do know that a little bit of alcohol can be soporific. It mm-hmm. can help you fall asleep. But it turns out people habituate, they need more and more of it, and then it ends up interfering with their sleep.
Okay.
The same thing might be true with cannabis. The data is still a little sketchy, but that's what we're thinking.
Uh-huh. So that's another piece of evidence that we are REM deprived, because we know that there are a large number of people are consuming alcohol. A large number of people are consuming, well, statins is one that you mentioned. And a whole heck of, I think the statin is the most prescribed drug.
It's up there.
It's way up there.
Yeah, it's hard to tease out the data. I focused more in this study that I did on psychiatric meds, because we encounter a lot of that in our work. And the largest category of psych med prescriptions in the world are benzodiazepines. And we've known for ages that benzos suppress not only REM sleep, but deep sleep and REM sleep. So it keeps us in lighter sleep. It keeps us from dreaming. It may well be that that's one of the mechanisms that it allows people to sleep. It could be that by suppressing the dream, we're holding back the processing of difficult emotions that would come up in the dream and possibly wake somebody up. So functionally, it's understandable. But in terms of practicality over time, I mean, we really don't have good data. Nobody's looked at what happens to a human being if their REM sleep is compromised for years and years. Although the data that we have on sleep deprivation is all tangled up with REM sleep deprivation. You know, a lot of the negative medical ramifications we attribute to sleep loss may well be the result of dream loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, just coincidentally, synchronistically, I saw a piece in a recent New Yorker written by Jerome Groopman. He's a MD and journalist. And he quoted somebody somewhere else that was saying that getting the ability to get a good night's sleep has become a sort of status symbol. Mm. I thought, that's interesting, that it's a rare enough experience that it's kind of enviable.
Part of the problem, David, is I'm going to sound critical of my own profession, but I think it deserves it. You know, there's been a dramatic uptick in the number of sleep specialists in the last 15, 20 years, mostly physicians, but also psychologists, an explosion of research, a tremendous initiative on public health education. The media has paid so much attention to sleep issues. And when I look at the data, the epidemiologic data, nothing is improving. In fact, things might actually be getting worse. So we have a problem here. The way we're approaching sleep and dream deprivation doesn't seem to be working. Now, clearly, we're pushing against some very powerful cultural forces. You know, there's a kind of relentlessness in our culture. You know, there is a hurry sickness, which seems to be getting worse and worse. In sleep, we call it hyperarousal. But I think we're missing the point here. And some of this relates to dream deprivation. So I think most of us are now familiar with the term hyperarousal. Or maybe I should say a little bit about it.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, we are aware that we dream at different levels or different stages. That we sleep at different levels or different stages.
Yeah.
This stage one, stage two, stage three, this REM sleep. Most of us aren't conscious of the obvious fact that we are awake at different levels of consciousness, too. And this is reflected in EEG. We can be in relaxed waking, maybe characterized by alpha waves. We can be in low beta, higher beta, or really high beta. It's a little bit like an airplane flying at different altitudes. But many of us now fly at higher and higher altitudes, metaphorically, where we used to be these little single-engine Cessnas, we're now Learjets. We're way up in the atmosphere. And
so you're saying that during the day, we're more worked up, more hyper than we used to be?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly easy to make that case, I think, just in terms of everything that's going on.
I think the inside of too many people's heads is like AM radio, right?
Oh, yeah. Noisy.
Fast and noisy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We don't spend much time in nature. I'm recalling from another earlier conversation that we had in one of our other interviews where you talked about, and I don't remember the term, but sort of dark reserves, places where you could go and look up at the sky and actually see the whole Milky Way, you know, which I never see where I live here.
I do see. I have two homes. I have a home in Tucson in the center of town. And Tucson is a city of about 1 million people. And it's rare because the International Dark Sky Association is based there. And Tucson has some of the most progressive night lighting regulations in the world. And so the quality of the light, the capping of the light, and from my house in Tucson, I could look up and see the Milky Way.
That's wonderful.
Now I'm out in the country, and of course it's visible here. But yeah, it's a big loss. So hyperarousal has been extensively studied, and it's associated with elevated core body temperature, people functioning in high beta EEG, increased cortisol, dysrhythmic cortisol, increased sympathetic activity at night. But people just get hype. And I think it's associated with something I've written about elsewhere called wake centrism. I think in the same way we used to be ethnocentric, we would go into other cultures and judge them in terms of the standard of our own culture.
Yeah,
I think today we in our world believe that waking is it. If we were fish, waking would be our water. It's the element we live in. It's what we see through. And, you know, fish don't really get water. Not until a fish happens to leap out of the water and say, oh, my God, there's unwater. Most of us don't get wake. You know, we see through it. And we're wakists. We judge other states, other profound states of consciousness. Specifically, we judge sleep and we judge dreams from a waking world perspective. We kind of downsize and subsume them. And hyperarousal, in my opinion, is essentially an addiction to waking life. I do really see it as an addiction. And I think insomnia, and one of the reasons we're not able to really make a dent in the insomnia, which is sleep and dream loss epidemic, is that we're coming at it with this huge bias, with this waking world bias. The waking part of us can't sleep. It can walk us to the edge of the waters of sleep. But it can't swim. We need to learn to let go of the waking self, mm-hmm. and then sleep appears. It's the default in consciousness. But that means descending out of this hyper aroused waking that we live in. And most people don't descend enough, or they don't have enough long enough landing strip, if you will. They can't slow down enough at night to really submit in a peaceful way to sleep. Instead, I think millions of people. The term is crash at night. They don't really do a soft landing into sleep.
That's right. That's one of the things we say, I got to go crash.
People crash, yeah. And I think the metaphor is very telling. But, you know, coming down, my belief is that what is missing in our approach to healing sleep and dreams is pretty simple. The antidote to hyperarousal is humility. Humility is a great word. It comes from humus, which means earth.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the English word bed comes from garden bed. Originally, it was the earth as well. And Mary Oliver has a great poem called "Sleeping in the Forest," where she captures the essence, this beautiful notion of coming back down to the earth, landing. The poem opens with, "I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly." There's a sense of a relationship, of returning to And it always reminds me of I had a dog for years, a Siberian Husky I used to play with, play Frisbee with. And he taught me a profound lesson about sleep and dreams. As we'd be in the midst of this passionate play, my phone would ring and I'd put it to my ear and he'd give me one of those curious dog looks like, really? What I noticed within seconds, he'd be asleep on the ground. And in archetypal psychology, of course, the dog is often referred to as the archetype of humility. They just know how to come down. They know how to come down. So I think we can learn from that. Getting to sleep requires humility. And I think the attitudinal shift essential to the restoration of our dream lives, which I think has profound implications for everything from personal mood to political issues, the essence of that is humility.
One of the things I'm thinking of is medical residents who are expected to stay up for outrageous lengths of time. And given that we know that performance and cognition decrement under those circumstances, that's appalling. If I have to have surgery, the person who's working on me may be only partly there.
Right, right. Well, you know, there have been laws enacted around the U.S. that limit the amount of time that you can keep a resident up. But there, you know, I teach in a medical school and I also teach residents, and these programs get around it a lot. It's a kind of hazing, really. The medical instructors pass on to the students.
Right. Yeah. And as you say, it's maybe symptomatic of something in our culture, you know. A real man or woman can take it, right?
Well, certainly there are moments when we can. I think resilience is important. You know, we are resilient, but that's different than chronic lifestyle patterns that really erode, you know, our health and erode our conscience.
I'm thinking of Silicon Valley, too, and all the high-tech companies where a badge of courage is that you don't sleep, that you're working late into the night and you don't even go home. You sleep in the office. You sleep at your workstation.
Right. Yeah. Like you're working in an emergency room.
Yeah. 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 With a lot of pressure. You're talking about the hyper, it's kind of go, go, go and be able to think real fast. Right.
Yeah. It reminds me of another decrement associated with dream loss. From the psychological perspective, we have numerous studies that have looked at how we perceive in the dream. You know, we've examined tens of thousands of dreams. And we know, for example, that the sensorium is expanded, that I can, in my dream, I can see in front of me and the sides, and I can see through the back of my head. I can just sense what's in the room I'm in. I can simultaneously see the building from the outside. So even though when we dream, of course, our senses are shut down, we can't see or hear or touch, in a way, we can think of dreaming as ESP. It's extrasensory perception because we're perceiving in a sensory fashion, but not with our eyes and ears and so on. Neither can we move, of course. We become paralyzed. Our voluntary muscles are offline in the dream. And so given that there's no sensory input, no sensation information coming in, there's no motor output, in a metaphoric sense, dreaming is an out-of-body experience. It's an OBE. And I talk to my patients and the people I teach about this. It's an experience in which consciousness is no longer constrained by the body, by the physical body. So, of course, we can fly in a dream. We can time travel. We can be ourselves. We can be someone else. We can be ourselves watching ourselves. So what happens in the dream beyond, and I believe dreaming is meaningful, and I know not everybody agrees with me, but beyond whatever meaning the dream has, when we dream at night, we are exercising another way of perceiving. We're exercising an artistic, a poetic, we're exercising expanded consciousness. So that takes me back to, you know, I work with Dr. Andrew Weil, and one of his first books was called The Natural Mind, published around 1970. where he made I think such a critical point, saying that there's an innate human desire to expand consciousness. Yeah. We see this in children who my grandkids will spin around until they're so dizzy that the world is,
yeah.
They'll tuck their head under their legs, look at the world upside down. They're always interested in broader, different ways of seeing. I think we've lost that in our world, and hyper arousal is associated with intense focus. It's almost like in waking life, we see the world through microscopes. You know, we focus in intensely. And the contrast, the balance, if we dream well, is it installs a more of a wide-angle lens in our perception. I call it a macroscope. It's a broader way of viewing. And when we dream, we exercise this enhanced kind of consciousness. We stretch it. It's a little bit, for me, it's a little bit, dreaming is like yoga of the psyche, yoga of the mind. It stretches the way of seeing. I think if we don't have that, it erodes consciousness. We lose our peripheral vision in a sense. It closes in and closes in, and gradually it's imperceptible, but we're seeing the world through smaller and smaller frames.
Yeah, you know, in the email that you sent me prior to, in the process of setting this interview up, you made a reference to shamanism, but without any particular context other than dreaming. So, and you just alluded to ESP possibilities. Say a little bit about where you see shamanism fitting into all this.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me of that. You know, what that does is it takes me back to a dream teacher, a shamanic teacher I worked with for about 8 years, pretty early in my career. And one of the things he taught us, we had a very small group that worked with him. And we initially were tracking our own dreams. We taught ourselves to awaken with every dream. And of course, we had volumes of recordings. But he also, he was so excited when any of us came in with a dream that was located in Latin America or South America. You know, so for example, I had a dream that was set in Brazil. I've never been there, but for some reason it was. And he'd get very, very excited.
Yeah.
I had some dreams that were set in Mexico. And over time, he explained to us that a lot of his learning also came out of alchemy. He was a scholar of alchemy, you know, and people thought the alchemists were these medieval kooks in Europe trying to convert lead into gold. Jung and many archetypal psychologists have studied their work and said, no, it's really it's a spiritual map. And a lot of their work had to do with dreaming, waking dream interpretation. Excuse me. The term alchemy, he told us, came from the ancient name of Egypt. Egypt was called Keme. And the alchemists, like my teacher, believed in this sort of geographic factor in dreaming. They were up in Europe. They believed that when their dreaming was based in South, in Africa or Egypt, for that matter, it was a really profound dream. So there was some connection between those cultures. And again, there was a geographic parallel that when you went down in the hemisphere, you were dreaming deeper and deeper. The reason I bring this up is it occurred to me, my dream teacher passed away this last year. And ironically, I ended up moving very close to Mexico. So I live very close to the border. And I'm fascinated with geopolitical boundaries and a metaphor for boundaries in psychology. But it occurred to me that all of this recent discussion about a literal wall, building a wall between the United States, between America, North America, and South America, I began thinking the wall was actually maybe a manifestation of an undercurrent that's been going on for some years, that we have been blocking our dreams. And the wall is a late symptom of that, that we're literally seeing this talk about blocking our connection with these cultures in a deeper world. Mm-hmm. So that's one shamanic bit of musing about it.
Yeah, wow. Was that Claudio Naranjo by any chance that you studied with? No. Okay. Just wondered. You go so far as to suggest that there probably should be a diagnostic category related to REM loss.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Where would that? You gave it some initials too. Do you remember what they were?
Dream deficiency disorder, RDDD. Yeah, REM or something like that. I'm not attached to
REM disturbance disorder or something like that.
Yeah. I do think in sleep medicine in particular, in my field and in medicine in general and clinical psychology, we really need to call attention to this. You can pick up a sleep study. Most sleep studies are done on sleep apnea patients. Many of them are also done to rule in and rule out narcolepsy. And you'll see a number on it. They will tell you the percentage of REM sleep. Normally, we like to see REM sleep 20-25% of the night. And very commonly, most commonly, we'll see studies that show REM sleep 10%, 5%, 3%. And it's not uncommon to see 0% REM sleep, particularly in apnea.
Yeah.
And so this shows up on the data portion of the polysomnography, the sleep study. And nowhere in the report is it mentioned. It's striking to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not mentioned. And the presumption is that that's really part of sleep loss, but it's not. And I think one of the reasons we need a specific diagnostic category is so that we start treating it and we become more sensitive to it. Physicians need to be aware that if they're going to prescribe certain antidepressants, they are suppressing REM sleep. Now, they might still choose to do that, but they need to be aware of that. Patients need to be aware of that. Psychologists need to be aware of that. I think this is a very challenging issue for me, too. And I was trained, probably like you, quite a few years ago, and dream work was a big part of my training. And then I did postgraduate training in dream work as well. It turns out there are a couple of papers now that show that there's been a significant reduction in interest in dreaming on the part of clinical psychologists or psychotherapists in general. And we used to be rooted in this, even if we weren't psychoanalytic per se. There was so much, it was just a key process of psychotherapy. Fewer and fewer psychotherapists are now asking their patients about dreams. I had a long discussion with the editor of a major psychology journal who was also a clinician, and he said to me, and this is a quote, "When my patients start to talk about dreams, I yawn." It really struck me, and I think he represents many, if not most, psychotherapists. Of course, there's a relationship between whether or not an individual psychotherapist pays attention to their own dreams and paying attention to the dreams of patients.
Yeah.
But this is another area that needs a lot of attention, is we really need to recognize the importance of dreaming in psychotherapy.
Pardon me. Has anybody, I don't know how long you've been putting out the idea that there needs to be a diagnosis. Would that be in the DSM or in some broader medical manual?
Probably ICD and the DSM, I would think.
Have you gotten any pushback on that or feedback from people who are substantial in the field who feel ready to embrace that idea or not?
I haven't gotten any formal feedback. I'm smiling. I did a presentation to a state sleep society not long ago on mindfulness and sleep. And
so I wanted to ask you about that.
Really the psychological side. These were mostly physicians I was speaking to. And interesting, after my presentation, I'm going to say a dozen or 15 of them, one by one, came up and took me aside. And with a confiding tone, they said things like, "I meditate."
I meditate.
I journal my dreams. Yeah, because I was talking about the psychological side of this.
Yeah. So
that was really striking. But you know, in sleep medicine in general, the field is one of the most highly medicalized medical specialties. everything is reduced to pretty much the brain or the body. And this is a deep concern I have. You know, so I was at a panel at the New York Academy of Sciences late last year, last December, and with some of my colleagues, sleep docs from Harvard and other places, and we were talking about dreaming. And one of the presenters, a woman I respect greatly, she was asked what's dreaming, she described what went on in the brain during dreaming. And this is pretty common. We'll describe what goes on in the brain during sleep, you know, or what goes on in the brain and body as if the brain sleeps. And my comment was the brain doesn't sleep. The brain doesn't dream. We do. It's a personal experience. And despite the explosion of research in sleep medicine, it's taught us a lot about sleep, but it's virtually forgotten the sleeper. The fact that it's an experience, it's a personal experience, it's a consciousness issue. And again, going back to the earlier discussion, I think this is the reason we're not making any significant headway in dealing with sleep issues. We're forgetting the sleeper, the personal experience of the sleeper. So to get back to your question, no, I haven't gotten any pushback. The article, the New York Academy of Sciences article on dream loss or dreamlessness actually sparked surprisingly, a lot of interest in India. I had a number of interviews with major publications there and a lot of their web publications. It made Time Magazine and Newsweek, but I think these are just little blips. And my concern is that we need a whole lot more attention called to this before we begin to see. It needs to be almost a grassroots issue. People need to remember their dreams. People need to be reminded that dreaming is important. They need to attend to their dreams. And one of the impeding factors I mentioned briefly in this paper is the alarm clock. And people think this is kind of funny, but alarm clocks are horrible. They're really terrible. Number one, if we routinely awaken with an alarm clock, we're never getting enough sleep. Number two, if somebody handed you a short story and then said, wait a minute, they said, well, this is a great story, but they said, wait a minute, and they tore off the last three pages. This is what happens when we're dreaming. We sleep off the end of every dream when we awaken with an alarm. So it's not finished. You know, the story is not finished. It's probably not fully digested or assimilated, if you will. And people, when I speak to public groups about sleep, I'll talk about the problems with the alarm clock, and hands go up and say, well, how can I awaken without an alarm clock, which is kind of an interesting question. And I tell them, we've discovered this very high-tech technique that we use for awakening without an alarm clock. It's called go to bed earlier.
Right.
That's all it takes. So
the other thing, I've always found that somehow my brain is self-programmable. I mean, if I have a need to wake up at a certain time, I will tend to do that without a clock.
Right. I think there's a small part of us, a small part of the brain or psyche that actually sets an internal clock.
Yeah. But
it's interesting, you know, David, if you sat down to have a fine meal in a restaurant, and they brought your entree over, but then the waiter came back with a timer and set a timer for 10 minutes and put it down. And when that went off, they came and took your meal away. You were done, whether you're finished eating or not.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, if you were getting into bed with your lover and your lover set a timer, I was like, oh, okay. When it goes off, they pop out of bed. We wouldn't think of truncating, you know, of corralling other natural experiences, but we keep sleep and dreams in their place. We want to tuck them in tightly into the night, really constrict them into the night so that they don't impede on our precious waking time.
You mentioned mindfulness earlier, and I've sort of half jokingly speculated that we are in the midst of a mindfulness bubble because mindfulness everywhere. Everybody's talking about mindfulness more and more, it seems. Mm-hmm. So what's the relationship, do you think, between what you're talking about in terms of REM sleep loss and mindfulness?
Yeah. Well, in general, I speak and I've written about mindfulness and sleep. Most of us believe that we can only be mindful of waking, right? because we're mindful of waking experiences. You know, when we meditate, we're awake. And many meditation training programs teach you to stay awake. I mean, in some Zen places, you'll get whacked with a stick. And again, I'm not arguing against mindfulness of waking life. And there's an interesting presumption in sleep science, and it's been there for years, that it's impossible. In fact, Will Dement, the head of the Stanford Sleep Center, a wonderful, brilliant scientist, pretty much the father of American sleep medicine, has stated in his classic book, The Promise of Sleep, that it's impossible to have awareness of non-REM, of non-dreaming sleep. It's just not true. It's just not true. And we've had spiritual writings going back for thousands of years talking about awareness of sleep. In fact, in Tibetan Buddhism, mindfulness practice, there is a whole sleep and dream yoga. The Dalai Lama has said it's one of the most challenging paths, and they cultivate awareness of sleep. And we're now getting evidence. Richard Miller, you might know, who's a psychologist who studies yoga nidra, and a number of others have been looking at EEG during meditation or yoga practices. There are people who go into delta EEG. They are technically asleep, and one of them can open his eyes, and they're totally present in the world. So this idea that we can't be aware of sleep, I think, for many people, has set up a barrier, the presumption that sleep is unconscious. Another ramification of this is kind of funny. There's a tremendous explosion now of interest in personal measurement of sleep. People are wearing watch devices, actigraphy, or rings. You can now purchase mattresses that have many built-in sensors. They'll measure your body temperature, your heart rate, your movement. There are pillows on the market now that'll do that. And there are people waking up in the morning consulting instrumentation to determine how well they slept. Mm-hmm. For me, that's a little bit like getting a device to tell you when you're hungry or you have to pee. It's like, come on, you know, if you slept well, you'll know you slept well. We've lost our self-efficacy around this, you know. We're pulled more and more away. And part of this is we're taught that we really don't have a direct experience of sleep and of dreams, but we do. So mindfulness of sleep and dreams, I was just teaching this at a conference in Portland yesterday. We can practice a mindfulness by mindful sleep onset. In other words, when we go to sleep, we close our waking world eyes, but the metaphor is we keep our third eye open. It's a non-sensory perception, and it's a meditative practice. It's ultimately a practice in being aware without objects of awareness, because as we go to sleep, there's nothing there pretty much. The thoughts start to dissipate. So it's a practice of what's called pure awareness. So we can practice that at sleep onset. We can also practice that at sleep offset. And I strongly encourage people to be mindful of grogginess. Now, that sounds funny to people. The word groggy comes from the English rum drink, grog. And the suggestion is that we awaken drunk. And again, it's quite disparaging. The truth is that grogginess is an exquisite hybrid state of consciousness. It's part sleep, part waking, and part dreaming. And if we allow ourselves to linger there without introducing a lot of waking intention, we will feel the serenity of sleep. We will linger in this inner peace. And also there will be images, there'll be bubbles of images from our dream that will come to the surface. It's one of the best ways to remember dreaming. Mm-hmm. So practice mindfulness at sleep onset, at sleep offset. And the other really interesting place to practice mindfulness of sleep and dreams is in the middle of the day when we are sleepy. And people don't often recognize that sleepiness is actually the emergence of sleep and dreamlike activity in the middle of waking. Okay, we fight it. We typically fight it, you know. But it's interesting to become mindful of that in the context of waking. So these are three arenas in which we can practice. And I think that kind of practice increases both the quality of our sleep and our dreaming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things that that I wanted to touch on with you, but maybe that answers it, which is what can people do to increase the amount of time that they're spending in REM? So you also, in your paper, you actually talk about dietary things. I forgot what the word, onirotic, what was that word?
Oniric,
yeah. That there are oniric foods?
Well, there are, possibly, there are oniric substances. The Oniruses, Nyx, the goddess of night, had lots and lots of kids. She gave birth to Hypnos, the god of sleep, who then gave birth to Morpheus, who was the god of major dreams. But mm-hmm. she also gave direct birth to the Oniruses, and these were lesser gods of dreams. Mm-hmm. And oniric substances, or Oniris comes from that. Probably the best known dream promoting substance, and the one I recommend a lot, is melatonin. Melatonin levels are very low at the beginning of the night, and they rise up, and we get a bump in the last third of the night. I believe that because we are so overexposed to excessive light at night, the vast majority of us in our world today are significantly melatonin suppressed, and this is another reason. Light at night is another reason we have poor quality or poor quantity dreaming. So we can supplement with melatonin. Unfortunately, I think there's so much misinformation about melatonin out there, and I really believe that a lot of the melatonin on the market is not very useful, and I think some of it actually may interfere with good sleep and dreams.
Now, I think I recall from a previous conversation that you use a sublingual melatonin, is that right?
Yes, yeah. I the ideal, I believe, particularly if you're going to take it close to bedtime, is a sublingual time-released or sustained-release melatonin. Melatonin is a short half-life, 20, maybe 30 minutes, 45 minutes max, depending. And so if you take a regular dose of it at the beginning of the night, you're going to get a bump at the beginning of the night, and then it's going to tail out. It's exactly the opposite of what nature does, what the brain would do, which is a tail at the beginning of the night and a bump. There are some products that are in Europe. It's complicated. There's a fellow who's been researching melatonin, Pierpoli, for many years, and he's not interested in sleep, but he's interested in longevity, and he's produced a product very, very hard to get in the U.S., but it actually mimics the natural release. Mm. You can get close to that. There are a number of manufacturers now who are producing time-release products that will sustain for about 6 hours. So the curve is more flat. Well, it'll build up, and it's more flat, but at least it's a little closer to what nature does. Melatonin, high levels of melatonin are strongly correlated with increased REM sleep. So that's something I believe can be helpful. There are other substances. There's something called huperzine that's available over the counter, huperzine A. Anyhow, I think if people want to begin experimenting with this, the first step would be to use melatonin. That should work for most people. There are folks who are interested in lucid dreaming and pushing it beyond, but the first step before you can become lucid of your dreams, of course, is to dream.
Yeah, and do I recall that melatonin production decreases with age as we get older, that we are not producing it at the levels that we were when we were younger?
With our age, and what I mean by that, I think we have to be careful and not presume that our experience of aging is normal aging, because we age in a world where there's a lot of exposure to toxic substances in our food and water and the air we breathe. We're underexposed to healthy light at night. Healthy light during the day. We're overexposed to light at night. We're underexposed to nature, and there are certain modulations, for example, in temperature rhythms in nature. So given all of that, and given the stress we're under, and given hyperarousal, this is how we age. Yes, so it turns out that the pineal gland calcifies, and gets what we call brain sand. So it gets less and less productive. But bear in mind, we've been whipping that little gland for years. We've been suppressing it night after night after night with overexposure to light at night. So no wonder it gives up.
Melatonin comes from the pineal gland?
It's made primarily in the pineal gland, in the brain. In fact, the brain converts serotonin into melatonin in the pineal gland.
Now, do we have any idea how Descartes came to associate the pineal gland with the seat of the soul?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't know. But, we know in lower animals, in birds, for example, the pineal gland is located right under a translucent bit of skin. And so it actually is sensitive to light. Light mm-hmm. passes through. It's almost like an eyelid, but light passes through. And in some lizards in the Australian, New Zealand area, you can actually see the pineal gland. It looks like a third eye. In humans, over time, in evolution, it just evolved back and back and back. But it still has very direct connections to the retina. The optic nerve sends messages to the pineal.
So in Eastern cosmologies, they refer to it as the third eye.
Third eye, yeah. It's
like so somehow they got onto that through, I assume, an internal root of meditation, sort of scientific approach from the inside out.
Yes, maybe there was some anatomical studies as well.
Huh.
I don't know. But yeah, it's been understood for a long, long time. It's associated with the chakra as well.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
Also produces other apparently psychoactive substances, very small quantities. It produces dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which some people have taken as a drug because it expands consciousness, similar to LSD.
Yeah.
So it's been referred to as the spirit molecule, DMT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, DMT is also a psychedelic that people are experimenting with, right?
Yes, and produced in the pineal.
Yeah. What about screen time? I think we've been hearing recently alarms being sounded about how much time young people are spending with their mobile phones, that many are sleeping with their phones, or in a certain age group that's very prevalent that they'll sleep with their phones. So some part of they're waking up many times during the night, in case somebody's dinged them, they've gotten a ping or whatever. That's got to have some bearing on the conversation that we've been having here.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the most common challenge is that there's a lot of blue wavelength that comes out of the light from screens, from computer screens, TV screens, actually most light, and certainly from our devices. So there's a strong element of blue that comes out of these. And blue light is the specific wavelength of light that sends a signal through the retina to the pineal gland to stop producing melatonin. So ordinarily, when the sun sets, it's starting to get dark, you'll get an up ramp of melatonin. But basically, this puts a red light on it. A lot of phones now, I have an iPhone, there's a device or there's an option under clock, I can show you right here. It's called bedtime. And if you set that, it'll actually change, I don't know if you can see this, it'll change the light, the quality of the light on your iPhone. It'll strip out the blue light, which makes it look more amber, more yellow. And that has less of an impact on suppressing melatonin. There are also applications you can get on your desktop, on your computer, that I have it on my computers. I can, even if my shades are drawn, I can tell when the sun comes up on my computer or when the sun goes down because the quality of the light will change. It'll add blue light when the sun comes up. It'll take out the blue light overnight when the sun goes down. Mm-hmm. So we manage this, and we can also, there's a lot of new technology in lighting. In my bedroom, all of the lights are low blue lights. I can turn on the light, but my eyes and brain will not read it as light. It'll experience it as being dusky. So it is less suppressive of melatonin. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, more supportive of healthy sleep and dreams.
I have an iPhone here. Mm-hmm. Where was that setting? I think I've got some kind of thing like that, but I don't remember anything that looks like what you just showed with the clock.
If you go into clock.
Okay, I've got my phone turned off so it won't ring during our conversation.
At the bottom, you'll see another icon that says bedtime. It's pretty explanatory. And if you click that, you'll have an option to turn that up in the upper right hand, turn that on. And you can set it. You can tell it when you want to wind down and what time you want to wake up. So it'll start setting, it'll start changing the light on your device. I have it set around 8 o'clock. The color changes, and then a rising time. And I'm not going to bed at 8. I go to bed, you know, closer to 10, 10:30. But the rising time around 6. But you can, I don't know if you can see that, you can just alter that easily.
Yeah.
That time.
Yeah, that's neat.
So yeah, there are these options. Speaking of technology, there was an interesting piece on NPR today about children developing relationships with tech devices. So, you know, we talk about people keeping their iPhones or laptops, whatever, in bed. It's a little bit, kids actually believe that Alexa, you know, Alexa, the Amazon device,
right,
believe that there's a woman living inside there.
Young
kids. And when parents speak to the device, they're role modeling, relating to an assistant, if you will. Mm-hmm. But of course, put one of these in bed, you know, you can talk to Siri at night. You can ask her what time it is. You know, you can ask her, you know, what the weather's like outside. So it's almost like having a partner in a box.
I've been writing about some of those things. I'm associated with an online journal called Age of Robotics, and I'm sort of head of the department for psychology and society. So I've been looking at a lot of those issues. It's all moving so quickly. There is so much new information coming out every single day that it's kind of overwhelming. You know, dare I admit that I watch television, and at about 7 o'clock at night, after I've had dinner, I start getting these waves of sleepiness. You were talking about grogginess earlier, mm-hmm. and I'm fighting them. Sometimes I just go over to the couch and take a nap instead. I'm with my wife. She just keeps watching TV. She's not suffering from this. But it's just pulling at me. And I'll close my eyes a little bit, and the images will start swirling around in my head and so on. Mm-hmm. Is that because the energy is being drawn to my stomach for digestion, as I've sometimes heard in the past? Or what do you think is going on around that?
Not. What you're describing, David, is it sounds like it's very common. It's called an advanced sleep phase. So the clock on the wall says it's 7:30. It's not quite bedtime. The clock inside your head is desynchronized. The clock inside your head thinks it's 10:30 or 11. Mm-hmm. And whether you take a nap, whether you go to sleep, or even if you stay up, it's going to start ticking off your sleep hours, and it will try to awaken you 7 or 8 hours later.
Mm.
If this pattern persists, it results in what we call early morning awakening. Very common as we age in our world. People are waking up, 3, 4 a.m., and they're up for the day. That's why we can get dinner in Miami at 3 p.m., right? Their entire sleep phase has changed. So no one's quite sure why this is. Some people would say that it's part of natural aging. I don't agree at all. I think, again, it's the result of aging in our world, in our overexposure to light at night, the toxic burden and so on, stuff I mentioned earlier. There is a way of managing this. And keep a relatively bright light on near where you're sitting. We recommend 100-watt light bulb if you're reading or watching TV. And over a period of a week or two, keep that on for a couple of hours at night. You will find that you're getting less and less sleepy earlier. It'll push light, will push your sleep phase back.
Hmm.
If it were summer or spring, I'd say, you know, go outside and take a walk for 45 minutes in the light. So more light exposure in the evening will push your sleep phase back.
You know, one thing I noticed that if I were to leave the TV, but go to my computer and start doing things on my computer, it wakes me right up. Right. So right. It's something about the passivity of watching TV, it feels like to me.
It may be, but it also, unless you have a filter on your computer, computers put out a lot of blue light, number one. Number two, it may be that it's a little more exciting. But, you know, I talk to some people who fall asleep watching these very exciting dramas. It may not be the content, but it's probably the light. And also, we tend to sit a lot closer to our computers, even though they're smaller, and there's more intense light.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's always fascinating to talk to you, Ruben, and hopefully this won't be the last time. And so maybe this is a good place for us to wrap it up, unless there are some other final words that you'd like to say.
Just encouraging therapists to look at their own dreams and begin asking about dreams, and encouraging people to begin attending to their dreams. I'll say one other thing. I really believe, you know, there's so many different theories about what dreaming is about, but I think if we begin to pay attention to our own dreams, they're just so compelling. And it's not even about discerning the meaning of a particular dream. So this reminds me of Joseph Campbell, who said, you know, we're not so much looking for meaning, we're looking for the experience of being alive. Now, meaning is a concept, and it's useful, but there's something about dreaming. Once we reconnect, we redevelop a relationship with our dreams, it's so compelling. You know, there's a great friend in the unconscious, as Rumi mm-hmm. would say. So I encourage people to turn back to their dreams, just reinitiate a dialogue with dreaming, and it'll, you know, the dream will guide you from there on.
Okay, well, that's a great reminder, and thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Always a pleasure, David. Thank you.
I always find Dr. Ruben Nyman to be such an interesting guest. He's both at the cutting edge of sleep research and sleep treatment, and also very broad in his perspective. Who knew that we're in the midst of an epidemic of REM sleep deprivation? Yet it's clear from the source of evidence Dr. Nyman cites in this interview, and even more so from his article in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences, that that's the case. One only has to look at all the TV advertising for over-the-counter sleep aids to sense that there is a widespread sleep problem in this country. I personally know of lots of people who complain about not getting enough sleep. I'll bet you do too. In fact, in his article, Dr. Nyman cites the following statistics. Quote, sleep disorders are among the most prevalent health concerns in the United States. About 30% of adults report some insomnia problems over the past year, while 10% report chronic insomnia, close quote. And we do know that good sleep is essential for mental health as well as good overall physical health. We've known for some time that depriving a person of REM sleep in the laboratory setting can lead to a variety of cognitive distortions and problems. One has to wonder how it is that this learning never got generalized to sleep problems in the broader population. Part of the problem, if I understand Dr. Nyman correctly, has been the tendency to separate sleep and dream issues into two camps: sleep medicine with a primarily neurological emphasis on the one hand, and dream analysis, which is focused on the subjective side of the experience, on the other. Dr. Nyman also writes, quote, emerging evidence suggests that REM/dreaming affects immune function, memory consolidation, mood regulation, as well as transpersonal/religious/spiritual experiences, close quote. All of this leads to the suggestion that there needs to be a clinical dream loss diagnostic category, such as REM/dream deficiency disorder. If you enjoyed this interview, you might want to listen or re-listen to my previous interviews with Dr. Ruben Nyman, episode number 420, A Model for Integrative Mental Health, number 302, Exploring Mindful Dreaming, and number 256, Mindful Sleep, Mindful Dreams.
Thomas here from upstate New York. I just want to say that I listened to my first podcast, number 354, What Aging Men Want, and I was prompted immediately to make a modest donation of $20. First, because I received the most prompt and personal customer service I have ever gotten when I called in a question to Dr. Dave about Shrink Wrap Radio. But much more significantly, after listening to just one program, I was inspired to get off the dime I had been sitting on procrastinating for weeks about contacting a shrink. And to boot, as a result of Dr. Robinson's interview, I have picked up a copy of The Odyssey to reread after 50 years since reading it the first time in high school. If you are into value, think about what you get. In today's economy, where a $20 bill doesn't buy you what a $10 bill bought in a grocery store just a year ago, you get with Shrink Wrap Radio hundreds of entertaining, insightful, and helpful discussions. They are free. Yes, indeed, and that is real value. But still, to help out with a few bucks, it is still real value when you think of this vast resource just waiting for you to discover new areas of enlightenment. Myself, I hate exercising, but I love listening. And now I'm walking more and longer because I am now listening to Shrink Wrap Radio on my MP3 player. Chip in and you will get a lot of value for your contribution. And you will feel good about doing so, just as I did. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom in New York. I have to agree with Tom that you get an awful lot of content here for free. Except that we do have expenses on this end, and your support is important to keep it going. If you're not already a financial supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please join Tom by going to our website and clicking on the big support button in the right-hand sidebar. You'll feel so glad that you did, and so will I. You might be interested to know that I finally decided to do something that has been suggested to me many times, which is to put out a selected group of transcripts as a book. I'm happy to report that Mahiar Alinagi in Tehran has offered to help me with this project. I don't know how long it will take us to carry this project through to completion, but tentatively, the book will be titled Varieties of Healing. I hope you'll want to buy a copy when it comes to fruition. And with that, I think we will wrap it up once again. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that. Thanks again to today's return guest, Dr. Ruben Nyman, for his observations concerning the deleterious effects of what he has called the silent epidemic of dream and sleep loss. My next guest will be Dr. Arlene Drake, and we'll be discussing her book, Carefrontation, which outlines her powerful approach to repairing the damage of childhood abuse and its lasting effects. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.